Chapter 33. The Price of Glory. It was an ordinary Sunday in Pakistan, the second workday of the week, as in all Muslim countries. The early morning streets of Islamabad and nearby Rawalpindi had the usual mix of third world and first world activities. Vendors, colorful motor scooters, men going into mosques, boys carrying tea trays, schoolchildren sitting in disciplined rows, government buildings opening for business. And then the world seemed to split wide open. Shrapnel tore into buildings, glass shattered, people were maimed indiscriminately. A half mile from what appeared to be the epicenter of the first explosion, strange apparitions were seen screaming through the air, tearing apart cars as they moved along highways. There was wave after wave of explosions, as the thundering blasts seemed to feed on themselves, and a mushroom cloud of dark smoke and fire billowed thousands of feet into the sky. Confusion seized the population, who believed that the capital was under attack. In the panic, rumors began to fly. Everyone knew that India had some kind of nuclear device. The more sophisticated presumed it was the Red Army taking its revenge. Many seemed sure that the Israelis had just bombed Pakistan's secret nuclear facilities. Still others insisted it was the CIA. Curiously, only this last speculation came close to the truth. Milt Bearden's Islamabad station had not, of course, launched this attack, but every one of those exploding weapons killing Pakistanis that day had come directly from the CIA. The source of the disaster was a stockpile of some 10,000 tons of ordnance haphazardly stored at the Ogiri military camp, just between the capital and Rawalpindi. The massive arms deliveries had been part of a huge last-ditch operation to funnel enormous quantities of sophisticated weapons and ordnance into the Mujahideen before an agreement to end the war was signed in Geneva. The Russians go to extraordinary lengths to honor their patriotic heroes. Every day of the entire Afghan war, in Moscow, Leningrad, or wherever Soviet veterans of World War II gathered, a commonplace drama occurred. Invariably, the old men would wear their medals on their chests when they went out in public, and as they entered a bus or subway, their fellow citizens would stand. Not just young children, but even old women would offer their seats out of respect and gratitude for the sacrifice these veterans had made for them, and as a thank you for their valor in defeating the Nazis in the Great Patriotic War. On May Day, Red Square would be filled with these veterans, most men covered with their medals as adoring crowds clapped and cheered. Not a day would pass that their country did not bathe them in glory for their deeds, in thanks for their sacrifice. In stark contrast, the Soviet veterans of the Afghan War did not exist. By official policy, for more than 5 years, they were not fighting a war. Yes, there was a limited contingent of Soviet advisors helping to build socialism and advising the Afghan revolutionary government in its efforts to suppress the terror campaigns of the bands of Dushman, or bandits, as they called the Mujahideen, but there had been no invasion of Afghanistan, and there were not 120,000 combat troops there. Soviet airmen were not carpet-bombing villages and laying waste to the countryside. There was no war, and no one was being killed or maimed there. It was strange, then, when the tin coffins began coming home in the special airplanes known as Black Tulips. These couriers of death would deliver their harvest with very explicit instructions for the mothers. They were not to note on the gravestones the fact that their sons had died in Afghanistan. A mother would be told that her son had not died in combat in Afghanistan, and that he couldn't be awarded a medal for valor because there was no war. The Soviet people were told that the enemy was broadcasting lies on its Voice of America and through the BBC, claiming that there was a Soviet war in Afghanistan. But then came the ugly whispers and the agonized, drunken stories that the thousands of young men were bringing back with them year after year. By 1986, it started to achieve a critical mass. The accumulation of these tales of the dark and ugly things that the young boys had had done to them in the far-off, exotic land, where Soviets were seen as infidels, where friend and foe looked the same, and where nothing seemed safe. Traditionally, in Russia, when a young man dies, his mother is given time to grieve and to prepare her child for the next world. It is a searing, sad experience, but there is dignity in it. It belongs to her. Family, friends, and neighbors participate as she honors her fallen hero. But during this war that was not being fought, the communist officials were forced to rob the mothers of Russia of their dignity. The mother of a fallen soldier was not permitted to acknowledge her son's heroism, his sacrifice, his patriotic duty. It didn't sit well. How could it when the numbers started to mount into the thousands? Sometime in late 1985, the mothers began to organize, quietly at first. A mother who has lost her son in such a way feels she has nothing left to lose. She cannot easily be intimidated any longer. The veterans also began to organize. Unlike their American counterparts, the Vietnam veterans who had returned home as individuals, the Soviet Afghan veterans had all gone off to war together as a unit from the same town or city, and when their tour was up, they returned as a unit. Throughout the Soviet Union, across its 12 time zones, entire units from the Afghan War began to resurrect themselves inside the civilian life of the country. They met at night to drink, to take drugs, and to recite poetry and sing songs of their experience. The songs contained the entire secret history of the war, an explicit account of all that the government insisted had not happened and was not then continuing. They told of the invasion, of the storming of Amin's palace. They told of the devilish Dushman and their comrades who had fallen in battle. There were songs about the black tulips and the tin coffins and the instructions to the mothers to lie for the state. The system that Lenin and Stalin had built had discipline, remarkable discipline, and for 5 or 6 years it had held up to the growing strains of the whispering campaigns that were being unleashed throughout the country. Everywhere the mothers were talking and complaining and asking questions. Worst of all, these young veterans now walking the streets were missing legs and arms, limbs lost in a war that never happened. The phenomenon only grew faster and more powerful because it was not allowed. By early 1986, everyone everywhere knew something of the horror of Afghanistan. Charlie's money had kicked in and Vickers's program was coming online. The Mujahideen were suddenly on the march. Everywhere they were taking to the offensive, ambushing convoys, assassinating Russian soldiers, setting off bicycle bombs and camel bombs and car bombs, shelling the Soviet embassy, shooting down helicopters and planes. They were dying, too. Oh, yes, the Mujahideen were continuing to die in far, far greater numbers than the Soviets and their Afghan allies. But the Mujahideen go straight to paradise, where the pleasures are so sweet. There is no heaven for the unbelievers. The unbelievers had only the black tulip. What sort of end was it for them? Their bodies packaged in tin coffins with a small window, if the boy's face had not been altered beyond recognition. And what of the mother, not willing to bury the metal coffin without checking to make sure her son was inside, yet not quite able to risk the sight and smell of what she might find if she opened the casket to see for herself? One of the songs the veterans back home sang was of a mother opening the casket and finding another young man's body. And even if it had been her son, what could she say? All she could write on his tomb to explain the sacrifice was, "Born July 28, 1964. Died February 8, 1985, fulfilling his international duties."